Tony Greer, trader and editor of the Morning Navigator. Welcome to the Common Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Tom. How you doing, man?
Excellent. I really appreciate having you on, Tony, and I want to congratulate you on your upcoming conference. That's a really exciting list of speakers that you got coming up.
It's a murderer's row roster, Tom. I'm really excited that I got everybody that I asked for, and I'm really excited to throw this conference down. It's going to be a blast. And by the way, congratulations on your new jersey there. I like it.
Thank you, sir. It's a little bit of a grind, but we're gonna get some really good content coming up. And it's a pleasure to work with people like you in this space. And it's always a pleasure to speak with you. But you've
Absolutely.
been pointing out recently that the commodities trade from here looks increasingly attractive. So let's start from a macro perspective. What is continuing to make commodities increasingly attractive? Is it basically a combination of underinvestment in CapEx in these sectors and basically the focus from the Trump administration to rebuild manufacturing and energy production?
I think that's a lot of it. I think the regime change is causing it, at its heart. And I think that because Trump came into office on his second term and didn't say anything about the stock market, he just gave us like a dozen bull markets to chase, right? And I say that because, whether it's coincidental, with his administration or not, but we finally got gold to break out to the upside, right? Like maybe because they think Trump is going to spend all the money in the world and we're going to have an inflationary environment, whatever it is. The gold market went first, and that's huge, right? We got gold miners up 150, 141% year to date, which is a totally new anomaly, right? Something that the market hasn't seen in a long time. So you start with that idea. You go from there into the idea that Morgan Stanley recommends holding 20% of your account in gold, right? So the new portfolio is 60, 20, 20. Right, where stocks, bonds, and gold rather than 60-40. And I think that that's a major sea change in the markets. And I think that it's going to force allocations to grow in the commodity space over time. So it goes from gold and then it goes into the flywheel of commodities that have been visibly taking off in different order. Like they have this random takeoff pattern assigned to them where gold went first. And everything else was sitting around, and then platinum took off, and everybody's like, "Platinum, that's fucking weird that that thing just went berserk." And then silver broke through $50, and then that gas went from 3.5 to 5, and now copper's through 11K, and you're sitting there looking at crude oil like a sitting duck at $60, and you're like, "Oh my God, if this thing goes to $100 and I don't have any from 60, I deserve a frying pan to the skull because they've all just been taking off one right after the other." I'm sure, in my opinion, this is still working off the Fed doubling the balance sheet for the COVID lockdown, right? This is the inflation that's being caused, right? They just got lucky in that the commodity sector had a blow-off top with that operation of doubling the balance sheet, expanding money supply, and backed off and then consolidated for 4 years. But after this consolidation, when it breaks out, I can bet you dollars to donuts that it's going to rally for 3 or 4 years. And I don't know where that's going to take it, somewhere into a new high. But I think that, the thing that gives me a little bit of confidence in that is that all of a sudden we got the performance from that sector this year, right? Gold miners up 100% and change, industrial miners up 75%, uranium miners up 79%, uranium, URN, both uranium ETFs are up huge. So my point is that, like, people are going to have to rethink their investing, themes, because you know that there are not a lot of mutual funds, plain vanilla funds, that are that long the metal space, versus all the tech that they own and versus all the healthcare that they own. They don't have any metal space at all compared to what they own in other sectors. So that's why I feel like if these sectors start performing, they're going to attract capital. And then I've got in the back of my mind the fact that we're clearly blowing some kind of bubble in AI. I'm not sure if it continues. It can continue, right? For however long it wants to. I'm not here to pick a top. But if I had to look at something where we're seeing visible signs of that circuitous finance, where the new headline is a new AI company investing in another AI company and a new AI company and that whole thing. And then there's this theme that's a much bigger theme that I have in my brain where we're kind of bumping into the next leg of AI being transhumanism, right? Where we're going to put a chip in people and it's going to help monitor their whatever, their vital signs, and help them, guide them to this. And it's going to help you get through a doorway or whatever it's going to do. And I don't know that that's going to work.
Get through or not get through a door.
Exactly. Get on your plane or not get on your plane, or get through the gate or not, you know. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think that that whole plan is going to work. So that's a completely different conversation, but I have that in the back of my head. Whereas if the AI thing is a bubble that's kind of getting full, because it's been, you know, NVIDIA has been kind of sideways for a while now, maybe it levels off and then dumps. But I feel like that sector is very susceptible. That sector is trading at risky prices. And I think that a lot of the commodity sectors are not trading at risky prices yet. Mm-hmm. You know, like they've rallied and stuff, but I still think that within the context of where they are in multiples versus other sectors, that commodities are still really cheap, especially energy. So I think that that's going to eventually matter, especially if it feels like rates are starting to fly higher around the world, you know, while we're trying to lower rates here. So if we're going to keep rates lower here, we're obviously going to be running the economy kind of hot, right? We see yields in Japan taking off, their ground zero for higher yields. And then we just had some yields rising in Canada and Australia. And here, you know, the U.S. has got a beautiful head and shoulders pattern at the bottom of the 10-year yield chart. We're just breaking through the neckline now. So maybe there's room for yields to rise quite a bit, which is a little bit of a Costanza trade with Trump hiring Hassett as his new Fed chair. He's going to come in as the, you know, dovish Trojan horse. And all of a sudden, we're in an environment that's inflationary and we've got to raise rates to combat that. So I feel like while that's not a done deal, and this isn't, I don't feel like I've come up with that idea. I feel like that's what the market is telegraphing.
Yeah.
You know, with the BCOM rallying, and that, you know, if I've drawn this chart that I've sent everybody, but it's like, you know, the BCOM's got this beautiful cupping bottom in this consolidation period where it's got lower lows, and then it bottoms, and then higher lows and higher lows and higher lows. And as you know, that kind of pattern, you know, kind of waiting to just break through the top side of that range. Mm-hmm. And see what happens. And that's what the Bloomberg Commodities Index is doing. So I feel like the group has got a lot of potential. I feel like this year's performance is going to lead it into a good year next year. There's been things going on that are like worth your time paying attention to, like oil services rallying hard in the last couple of months. You know, I feel like that might be trying to tell us something. Airlines are breaking out. Transports are breaking out. All kind of adjacent to a strong commodity trade, right? We always have strong transports when the commodity trade is ripping. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fair to say that the market is teed up for that for next year. If you try to think big a little bit, whether that's going to happen, I don't really know. You know, maybe there's another leg up in semiconductors, and the AI trade could totally happen, you know, and maybe that gets leadership for a little while. But I feel like, you know, with gold leading the charge, I feel like it's finally drawing the right amount of attention to the space via the right angle, if that's fair to say. You know, I mean, everybody's going to need some kind of hedge against fiat currency debasement if they don't have one already.
Yeah.
So you can only think that, you know, between gold and Bitcoin and some of the other store of value trades gaining popularity over time and attracting capital. So I guess that's why I'm kind of in the world that I'm in right now, kind of trying to get my book prepared for that. Mm-hmm. That's fair, Tom. So we're long, you know, on the Navigator, we're long gold, we're long gold miners, we're long industrial miners. We just bought airlines, and we're long Bitcoin. We were patient and waited for Bitcoin to break down and bought that at 82K. And now we're kind of, I guess we are benefiting from our patience now since it bounced. We waited for a nice pullback, got it near the lows. We're managing the risk. But I think that's one of the store of value trades that might be necessary in portfolios as well going forward. So as that kind of trade becomes more and more mainstream and popular, I think it builds a great case for the commodity sector. Mm-hmm. And I know it's becoming a little bit more of a popular call in the last couple of days. You know, a couple of investment banks have been coming out with it, but that's because that's what the market's saying, you know, and the chorus around it is going to get louder as we go and as it goes up, certainly. So I certainly know, you know, we got silver trading on an all-time high as we speak, $60.66. You know, that thing looks like it's got a date with a hundo. you know, the way it's behaved on the breakout through $50 and the double top at 55 that we annihilated. And so all of this stuff, it makes me bullish the sector, Tom.
Do you see the silver situation as a short squeeze possibility on top of an industrial demand picture?
You know, I don't look at it like that because I don't believe that there's that giant naked short at JP Morgan or something like that. Or I don't believe in the people that say that there's the morning crash and it's the powers that be trying to knock the price of, like, that's abundant horseshit, if you ask me. So I think that silver is benefiting from its beautiful position right now as both an industrial and a precious metal. Mm-hmm. You know, and so if the industrial demand is going to be there ad infinitum now, you know, or at least, you know, we're going to need silver for this whole new power generation trade for AI and among other things that are going on, silver is going to be a sought after commodity. And now it's doing historical things. So people are taking notice.
Mm-hmm. You know, I spoke with Mike Green a couple months ago, and he brings up this idea of the weight of passive investing funds and their effect on the market through, let's say, the last decade. So is that part of, you think, this rebalancing of passive funds coming into the sectors that are outperforming, like these commodities, miners, and energy sectors? Is that another part of it?
Yeah, you know, I guess it creates demand when there are new, you know, funds or ETFs created. But I think part of the commodity strength is due to rejection of the paper trade at some level. Like, you know, we've been building, you know, we've got derivatives on derivatives and, you know, all of these upstairs products and leverage products and this and that. And I feel like a little bit like the metals markets taking off is kind of a rejection of the paper markets. Mm-hmm. Saying like these are a house of cards, kind of the way Mike Green looks at passive investing, where at someday the dam is going to break. And I don't mean to speak for Mike, he's a brilliant guy, so I don't want to put any words in his mouth, but I think that's kind of his angle, that this creates a risk that, you know, we should be mindful of, and we certainly should. It just doesn't really overlap with my jujitsu of making money on short-term levels. You know what I mean? Like, the market's going to collapse. My system is going to have me out of everything before it collapses. And I don't hold the bag in any trades at all. So I'll be on my toes for that kind of an unravel. But I more think that it's all of the derivatives and things that we've created on the markets and things like that, that are partially the reason why fiat currency is losing value and the metals trade is working.
Mm-hmm. Tony, when you're looking at this Bitcoin position, is that from a, you know, mostly a charting perspective, or do you take into account the 4-year kind of cyclical nature of Bitcoin and also kind of the ETF inflows as well?
Well, there are certainly, you know, the ETF inflows are part of the guide to the trade. You know, that was really interesting to me that as Bitcoin backed off, there were still net inflows on some of these huge down days. And that's why I started doing some homework and picked a level on the charts that I thought would work. And so the trade came to me. But I'll be honest with you, Tom, it's just because I'm a red-blooded trader trying to make money, right? If that chart were elephants doing the same thing, I would have bought it at 82K for however many elephants I got. Just because it was like, you know, it's a marquee security. So everybody in the world is looking at it and trading it. And we've got new investors in the ETFs, et cetera, et cetera. And it's become, you know, whether the Bitcoin community likes it or not, it's become a lot more like another security, where when positioning and sentiment gets overheated, it sells off. It creates sellers, right? There's more longs than shorts out there, and the longs get uncomfortable and it knocks the price down into another auction, you know? So it's no longer that game of, and not to mention the fact, Tom, I think that the thing changed a little bit in Bitcoin is that we had that $9 billion seller, mm-hmm. right? That whale seller. Now, people can overlook that. But what I think it does is that erodes the idea of laser eyes, and it erodes the idea of being diamond-handed holder forever, hodling, you know, whatever the Bitcoin guys want to call it, right? That was their strategy right from the beginning. Hold on for dear life forever. We don't trade. What is our trade? It's be long Bitcoin. That's the trade. That's it. And then all of a sudden, some OG whale that they called him sold $9 billion worth of Bitcoin. What changed?
Somebody wanted to take profits.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so my point is, the laser-eyed guys are going to come to me and say, like, yeah, like, you know, if you had $9 billion worth of Bitcoin, you would take profit too, to which I respond, I'm not the guy that was saying hodl it forever. Mm-hmm. You were. That was you. Remember the magic carpet ride that everybody was going to be on that was long Bitcoin? You remember have fun staying poor? It was because you were never selling your Bitcoin. And now all of a sudden we have a guy that was like, you know what? Take $9 billion. I'll take the cash. I'll do something else with it. And down goes the price a week later.
Yeah.
So my point is that had to change. You know, the more times you get these damaging pullbacks, the more these people are going to be inclined to make a sale at some point, right? So it's just slowly eroding that idea that to participate in the Bitcoin market is to buy as much as you can and fold your arms and never do anything else. Mm-hmm. That's your trade. Like, that's not a trade to me.
So, well, yeah,
that's relevant.
It's certainly not a trade, but it's also, you know, maybe that starts to change that idea or that sentiment within that community, because it's not, you know, even when you called it a store of value trade, I still think that has to be proven yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, my thing, I don't really understand everything about Bitcoin by a long shot, but but the thing that I feel like is, like, why does the price have to go up ad infinitum for Bitcoin to work and for Bitcoin to be, you know, more widely used and become an instrument in finance? You know, why does the price have to go to $200,000 or $300,000 or $1 million per Bitcoin? Like, if I remember, like, I don't think there's a single Bitcoin target that got hit this year.
Yeah. I recently saw a list. It was like, I don't think there was anything under 220,000.
Right. Exactly.
2025.
Right. There are all these, like, pie in the sky, random numbers. A guy predicts $1 million. Like, get the fuck out of here. Just get out of here.
Well, that was Michael Saylor.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, true. I thought there was one or more people that said that, but it went right. Okay, so even if it's Michael Saylor, it's like, especially him, get the fuck out of here, right? Like, you're running a business. I understand you're long the whole wad of 640,000 Bitcoin, you know, and he's got it set up where people should be buying the stock when it goes below the market cap of the Bitcoin that he owns, you know, and he's got a some kind of a, you know, circuitous financing deal set up himself on the preferreds, and it's unbelievable product, but it you know, the stock certainly has faced some rough waters going from 300 to 150 in a couple of months. So who knows if he's as happy with the strategy as he was a couple of months ago, right?
Tony, everybody talks about positioning and crowded trades. How do you actually measure when something is truly crowded versus just consensus?
You know, it's by the people that make the comments about it. You know, like right now, the silver community is very giddy, you know, and you'll start to see, like, when you'll start to see more new people come out of the woodwork and get giddy and post, you know, and that'll be the idea. You know, hubris is visible. You know what I mean? People that are bragging about how much money they make are they stand out like a sore thumb.
Yeah.
And in every community, there is the group of people that are like that. It's usually a group of young individuals that haven't been served a humble pie by the markets yet. And, you know, they're all excited that their position is up however many percent, whatever. But it's really a vibe that you get from talking to everybody. You know what I mean? It's going to come up in almost every conversation. It's a question of how.
Yeah.
You know, you look on FinTwit and everybody's got a comment about it, you know, and so it's that's kind of how you can gauge it. You know, you can tell when sentiment gets red hot and when it's not and things. I think that's fair. Mm-hmm.
Tony, the Bank of Japan is finally done, or do you think that they are finally done with yield curve control, or do you think they're one bad deflation scare away from going back?
Dude, that trade is beyond me. With, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not an economist and I'm not even focused outside the US right now, just to be in fairness. Mm-hmm. I feel like the opportunities that are available now in the Trump administration with all these sectors and their individual stories, from AI to power generation to the pharmaceutical story, to healthcare, like across the board, like this administration is a regime change. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that if I study that close enough, I'll come out better in the wake of it. I've got kind of a noise cancellation policy on international trading right now, if that's fair. You know what I mean? And I've even dialed it down to like, I'm really trying to just stay like stocks and commodities centric and let the dollar and the bond markets be the speedometers on my dashboard mm-hmm. that will let me know how hot I can take this trade or something like that.
Well, so perfectly, you know, in that idea, Tony, what do you think the bond market, the US bond market is telling us right now? Like, what do you mean by how hot you can take that trade?
So rates are rising, and it's the kind of thing where that might be okay for the markets. Mm-hmm. It might cause rallies in different, you know, we're in a secular bull market in stocks. Stocks have risen during periods of rates rising. If you're familiar with that, we've gone through periods where the economic growth will offset rising rates, and it's no problem for the stock market. Stock market can bear rising rates. So I'm anxious to see if that continues to be the case now. It looks like the bond market is, you know, either getting a whiff of inflation, following the other global bond markets and saying, okay, if these guys are all getting destroyed, everybody's got to take a little bit of heat in their credit market. And so, it's okay with me to see this happening. And by the way, you know, while there looks like it could be a serious breakout in US 10-year yields, mm-hmm. let me reframe it for you and say that we are now approaching the median range of the last year, right? So all this happened in one phase of the game is rates were on their lows for a little while. We chose a new Fed chair that Trump picked that everybody thinks is going to be dovish, and rates rose back to the middle of the range, right? That's not an event. That's not an interest rate event.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what I feel like so far. I'll give the girl credit for pointing out the Helene Meisler, I think is her name, of pointing out the inverted head and shoulders in 10-year yields. Definitely a visible pattern. It's definitely rising to the neckline. And at the same time, that neckline is in the middle of the range. And by measured move, if we measure the neckline to the top of the head or the bottom of the head in this case, and we turn that upside down to see what a target for this breakout in yields is, the target is probably like 4.5% in the 10-year. So right up to the top of the range again. Right. So that's all this trade has in it for me right now, right? That's what I'm looking for. Is this a real head and shoulders? Is it going to break? And then we're going to go the distance from the head to the neckline on the top side. And where's that going to put us? 4.5%. Is that a breakout? No, not even close.
Yeah.
You know, so like if it keeps going and gets towards five, then we'll be sitting up in our chair. But as of now, there's nothing going on in the bond market.
So how does that inform you for how you position or want to be watching from a risk perspective in your stocks?
You know, it says that I can step on the gas a little in my metals trades and things like that, because commodities tend to thrive in rising rate environments, right? It's kind of like a flywheel of like, oh, the bond market's picking up inflation. Why? Because commodities are rising. So do what? Buy commodities, because they're going to keep going up. Like we're in the middle of breaking out now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like we've been rallying commodities for 10 years and they're still going. We've been sideways for 5 years, broadly speaking, and we're breaking out. So the market's picking up one thing, and it says to me that I can kind of be longer these stocks as long as they're still performing. Right. Gold and silver can certainly go up in a rising rate environment. And so for my metal stocks, my metals and mining, gold miners, et cetera, I need to see them going up with gold and silver while rates are going up. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that breaks down or changes or inverts, God forbid, I can stay in these trades and stay pretty much kind of maybe longer than usual. Right. Because now we're getting into a little bit of a friendlier environment. It feels like the market's precursoring a little bit of inflation, maybe. So that would be the story. If you know, maybe if there was a, you know, crazy bid for bonds and rates were falling, there might be another reason to be long metals, right? Maybe that is a flight to quality move in the bonds, and people rush into gold for a flight to safety alongside that, mm-hmm. right? It depends. And then now you try to think like, what's going to knock gold over? you know, not until sentiment and positioning get overweighted on the long side, or some investment bank stands up and says, we're done printing money. You know what I mean?
Well, so I think these periods of consolidation that we're, you know, seeming to have right now, that cools and brings sentiment back into moderation, right?
100%, 100%. Even just the lack of performance. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Gold's up 140. Gold miners are up 140% year to date, and they stopped. You know what I mean? So people are going to have to make sales. They have to adjust. They have to decide where they are in gold versus gold stocks, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's the cycle that keeps repeating in a bull market. I'm not saying the bull market's over. You know, we need to get some longs rinsed out of the metals markets. It doesn't look like it's going to happen in silver with them adding to longs above $60.
Yeah.
Right. It rather looks like that thing's going to go probe new high territory. Gold looks great because it won't even touch moving average support. Like, it won't even touch the 50-day because there's so many buyers in line down to that price that all it does is sag towards it and bounce.
Yeah.
You know, if we get some good shorts in the market, maybe we'll get the next leg up in gold. You know, maybe we get them rinsed out on the long side and it bottoms out and we go after that. I don't know. But there's no bear case really for gold aside from when positioning gets overweighted to the long side.
Mm-hmm. Tony, you mentioned that your system doesn't let you be a bag holder at any point. How has your risk management evolved from your early career until now?
Well, there's a point to make with that, and then a point to make with my sort of method of trailing stop losses. But I would say that, you know, my analysis, my trading has gotten better when I stepped away from being a salesman in equities and became like, you know, an independent analyst and newsletter author. Mm-hmm. That's when I started focusing really hard on the things that came naturally to me in creating a process, which is following the performance of all these securities on a weekly, on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and yearly basis. You know, and once I started doing that, I stopped predicting what was going to happen and putting on those positions and saying, this is what is happening. I'm going to put on these positions. And my profitability went through the roof versus where it used to be. So that's been a good development. And then to address the fact that I don't get caught holding the bag is that, like, I'm a trailing stop loss guy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I'm long security and it's working, I just keep moving my stop up. And then eventually I get taken out of a long position. And that's usually before any panic sets in, you know, and that's a less stringent. I sort of have looser risk controls on my long-term accounts, mm-hmm. but they're there in enough of a capacity that if there's a serious sell-off in the markets, that I'll be lighter for that by the time that starts happening.
Do you have a rule on how tight you run that stop loss? Like, is it like 10% on, let's say, every market you trade, or do you have different allowances for different markets?
It's different allowances for different markets. And it's also kind of where I am on the year, you know, and I mismatch my book from the calendar because I don't like when my P&L coincides with everybody else's year-end P&L. I kind of just offset it by a month and I start fresh managing mine in November. So I guess, I forgot what I was going to say, but through year end, it kind of takes me out of that year end kerfuffle. And in the beginning of the year, I'm going to start off with super conservative stops just because, you know, you can't get buried at the beginning of a year. It takes you out mentally. It handcuffs you in terms of getting back in the ring and trying to, you know, fight your way back to flat. So it's a matter of trying to keep things tight and stack really small chips in the beginning of the year, of the quarter. And then, you know, by the time we get to the middle of next year or the first quarter of next year, I've already had a couple of months of P&L and I can sort of see what's going on in the markets and kind of bet that way.
Right.
I don't know if that makes sense. It's a little bit of a nebulous idea and it's kind of a creative thought and it might be very personal, but it's kind of how I look at it.
Well, and I think that's also tailored to your trading strategy and, like, let's say the feel that you develop through that year, right?
Totally. Totally. And also, you know, my methodology for my clients is, you know, I'm always trying to get them overweighted into the sectors that are going to win the year, right? So we got them into gold miners this year. We got them into industrial miners. You know, we got into Bitcoin. You know, we try to get into those things that are winning on the year and see how they do over time. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just trying to, we're trying to buddy up to the best trends in the market, if that's fair. Mm-hmm. You know,
Tony, stepping back a little bit, which widely believed Wall Street narratives do you think are complete nonsense?
Oh man, I don't know where to start. We could talk about, we could talk about multiples being a farce. I feel like I picked that up early in my career, where I, like, you know, I worked at a couple of shops that were very research sales oriented and very multiple oriented. And I mean, I feel like you can prove eight ways through Sunday how it's really tough to perform in a market if you're concentrated on what multiple of earnings the stock is trading at in a world of a liquidity fire hose, mm-hmm. right? That your job is to put your money where it's treated best, not to mathematically average it against its peer group, in my opinion. So I guess there's that. And the fact, you know, the Wall Street firms work their employees to the bone, you know, and I think that the employees buy into that, into the Kool-Aid, that the more hours they put in, the more productive they'll be and the more powerful the firm will be. And I don't know that that's necessarily true, having worked under those conditions and then having come out of them and see that there's like a different way to approach markets and approach risk management. And it's not always, you know, sitting there staring at the screens 24 hours a day, you know, but that's some of the pushback that I would give against the traditional Wall Street theories and things like that, if that's mm-hmm. fair. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly an idea that too much information is actually a handicap rather than something that is complementary to what you're doing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I put it this way, man, my noise cancellation policy is my best friend.
Yeah.
Because like when I'm focused on something and really, you know what I'm getting into, et cetera. And no offense, Tom, but then somebody says, tell me about Japan. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but that's on my noise cancellation policy. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to think about it. I just move on. I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I know whatever my brain cells have picked up in the periphery, but really I don't know anything about what's going on or enough to speak intelligently to inform somebody with a view on it. So that, and so it works with that, and it works with like social things too. You know, like when social things get really big, like something that happens in sports or reality TV, I'm always like, nope, not going to go chase that storyline down. Like I call it the Terry Schiavo policy. You remember that? Do you know that name?
It rings a bell. Tell us about it.
Oh my God. Terry Schiavo was a woman that was essentially became a national legal case about whether the doctors were able to put her to death or not.
Right.
And it was a story that never ended. Mm-hmm. And it hit the headline. Like every day it was front page news, and it was this poor woman on her deathbed. And I liken it to the most agonizing story that has soaked up more eyeballs and wasted more time. You know what I mean? It's just like one of those things where it's like this story, the media has gone rabid with this and it's all they can talk about. As soon as that happens, that's when I'm like, oh, nope, I'm not going to do a second of that. I'm doing zero of that input, you know?
Yeah.
So
I can absolutely appreciate the nonsense filter, let's call it.
Yeah. That thing that covers everything. You know, the market filter, you got to be a little more discerning about.
Yeah.
Make sure your trade isn't being directly affected or knowing if it is. But the culture war stuff is just like, nope.
Yeah.
I'm not finding out. I'm not going to go. What was the latest? I always joke around and say, I'm not finding out what matcha tea is. I don't know. I'm not going to go look into it.
Yeah.
It's fine that there are stores all over the place, but it's on a noise cancellation policy. It's a cultural phenomenon I do not care about.
It's like Canadian politics for me.
Yeah. You know,
even though I'm Canadian, it frustrates me to no end. Anytime I try to read anything about it, it's just the most ridiculous set of policies. And I have to shut it off because I get too frustrated by it. Yep. And it doesn't add to my life in any way, shape or form.
And the inverse of turning it off brightens your day.
Yeah,
Whether
exactly.
you know what I mean? You start to notice that. You notice the absence of the agony, and you're like, oh, this is blissful. It's just not paying attention to the rat race that everybody else is chasing down. Oh, God, I don't care. Right.
Well, right in that, Tony, what sources of information have you found that deliver you consistently high signal to noise ratio?
All the guys that are speaking at my conference. Those are the guys that I consume at like a
That wasn't
hundred.
a softball, by
No,
the
I know it wasn't, but it's the answer, quite honestly. Like,
way.
like those are the guys that I consume on a 100% basis, meaning I follow them. I follow what they say on Twitter. I read their newsletters. I read their publications. I consume their content, and it helps inform my decisions in a number of different ways. I look at it like I've got a couple of like trading coaches out there. Like Grant Williams for a big picture perspective, and Cuppy for knowing like where the value trades are and what's absurdly expensive, and Brent Johnson and JJ for understanding the metals and the monetary trade, and Jarrett Dillon, and Doomberg for understanding energy and things like that. But that's quite honestly, that's what I consume now, and very little else. You see the headlines by investment bank go by. I wouldn't read a piece of investment bank research if you paid me to. You know what I mean? I just feel like there's much better content and quality. I've been more informed on stocks by searching the ticker on Twitter than I ever was reading a research report that Wall Street Investment Bank put out.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's like, if you want to be informed, that's where the opportunity is. That's where it's coming from. It's not all pouring off of these upstairs desks and reports that are this thick. Like, I don't know. This is that there's no value in that to me.
You have a small group of very focused experts
Yeah, that's it. The guys
that you trust or that have earned your trust.
It's guys that I think that I think have their own way of looking at the world the right way, and I kind of just look at them to see what they're saying. How are you looking at the world? What are you seeing? I got my notepad here, and then when there's some sparks that fly in between, I go, ooh, what do you think of this? I saw that too. What was that all about? What do you think? What's the story? And that's when you get the best information.
Tony, what do you think the markets look like a year from now?
I think commodities are a lot higher if we got to go with this telegraph. Like, a lot of those charts don't look like something that's going to go right back in the bottle soon. I don't know. I think there's going to be more volatility in the Bitcoin trade. I think that that's going to be, I think it's going to be a real challenge for that thing. Bitcoiners are used to that thing just busting back to the highs and keep going. And I think it's going to be a little bit more of a challenge this time. And so one of the things that I could see happening is Bitcoin failing another attempt at that like quintuple top that it's got, and backing off hard. And I'm not saying that's the end of it. I'm saying that's I'm saying that's like an episode that I feel like it's got coming to it.
Just another trading opportunity.
It will be. But I feel like it's fair to say that I bought it, but I'm not that confident that the lows are in. Like, I'm going to sell it on a move back to 100, above 100K. Like, I'm gone. That's a 25% trade for me in a month. You know what I mean? See you later, buy. And whatever happens from there, I don't know. I can always buy it back on a breakout. But to me, that's where I'm going to let it out and see if it's got that magic power in it that it's had to just kind of annihilate the chart and fucking go. So so we'll see. That's something that I could see happening. But one of the other things that I like is I think that gold miners are like they're up 150% this year. That's one thing that I'll go against my knitting and say, man, on a valuation basis, they're still cheap. So I feel like they could be up 200% next year. Especially if, we have some end of meetings at some big plain vanilla mutual funds that say, you know what? Let's increase our allocation to the natural resources space by 50 basis points, on $1 trillion. And then the next thing you know, gold miners are fucking 120 bid, and the whole world changes. But I do feel like that next year has got that acceleration in the precious metals trade in it. We're going to make another new high. Like, it doesn't feel like it's done, especially after this beautiful consolidation at the highs in gold, where it's retaining value and not breaking down. Like, that gets me excited for like a $300 leg up from here. Like, that's what I think is coming next. So those are the things I'm looking for, man. And thanks for forcing that out of me. I'm trying to get a year end, get some year end ideas out, and it's very hard for me. I'm a short term trader, so I have no crystal ball at all.
Do you think the dollar is in, you know, the early stages of losing this reserve status, or do you think that's still decades away?
Not unless, no, we still have bigger aircraft carriers than everybody else.
Yeah,
I think that's the reserve status trade, and I feel like they're trying to build Bitcoin into the dollar financing system. You know, like I feel like stable coins are kind of an interesting thing that I don't fully understand yet. But I think it's very interesting that people are going to be able to hold dollar reserves outside of the US. Mm-hmm.
Something I've been trying to wrap my mind around quite a bit too.
It's very difficult to know what's going to happen. It's impossible, but to kind of look at it and try to figure, you know, what that's going to mean. And to me, that's kind of that probably helps us maintain reserve currency status, if that's fair. If we have all these stable coins that are now looked at as sort of a branch of treasuries that are kind of whatever, a yield that you can count on or somewhat backed by something or whatever. So I feel like that episode is coming too. So
yeah. Tony, let us know when your conference is.
Yes, February 19th and 20th, 2026 at the Virgin Hotel in Nashville. If you've never been there, you got to go to Nashville at some point. I've been there like 20 times in the last several years because I'm a music guy, and it's like Las Vegas for music fans.
Nice.
You know, it's really amazing. So I'm excited to have the conference there. I'm excited for the roster. The hotel is hip as hell. Super cool, typical Virgin Hotel. It's a little bit 10 minutes cab ride off of the main ground zero of downtown, which I very much like. You know, if you want to take a walk and have some peace and quiet, it's all right around the Virgin. So I'm excited for that, man. It's going to be amazing.
Awesome. Well, I wish you the best for it. And of course, if anybody else or wants to check out more of Tony's work, that's all available at tgmacro.com and as well, tgmacro.substack.com. Tony, thanks so much for your time today, man.
Tom, you're the best, man. I'm excited for your new career here at this place. And I wish you a lot of luck. I'm here whenever you need me.
Always appreciate it, Tony. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, brother.